From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, State Representative Sarah Anthony on armed protests at the Capitol and making the most of a crisis.
This is probably one of our only opportunities to crack open these systems, to not just go back to the way we were, but actually making them work for everyone.
Also, new details emerge about a mysterious condition affecting children. Doctors believe it's related to COVID-19.
And some of these kids are very sick, sick enough to require a ventilator or even a heart-lung bypass machine.
We'll speak with the Free Press reporter who uncovered the story and Secretary of State Jocelyn Benson on what to expect in November.
We know two things about this fall's elections with certainty. One, that they will be held on time and on schedule, and two, that every citizen will have a right to vote by mail.
Those stories, plus the pioneering architect who shaped some of Michigan's best-known malls. Stay with us. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Later this hour, a quickly evolving story about a COVID-related condition that has infected dozens of children in Michigan, challenging the conventional wisdom that kids are safe from the pandemic. But first, protesters are back at Michigan's Capitol today. Some gathered in front of the Capitol building in Lansing. Others stayed in their vehicles and beeped their horns as they drove through downtown. It was more dissent against Governor Gretchen Whitmer's stay-at-home orders to slow the spread of COVID-19. Rick Pluta is Capitol Bureau Chief for Michigan's public radio stations, and he's in Lansing today. Hi, Rick.
Hi.
First, how was the turnout today? Was it relatively represented despite the rain?
There were 200 to 300 people, according to an estimate from the Michigan State Police, which is also responsible for Capitol security. And attendance might have been tamped down today by the fact that we are having a torrential rainstorm here.
There are reports that a fight broke out among protest goers over a Barbie doll hanging from a noose, a dark-haired Barbie doll. What do we know about what happened there?
I don't know a lot. I heard that story, and the state police say that there was an altercation between two people that had to be broken up. There were no arrests, although apparently one person was counseled on appropriate behavior.
The thinking was perhaps that the doll was intended to represent Governor Whitmer?
I wouldn't be surprised that there were a lot of signs here today that were, I mean, this is a rally to oppose the actions that she's taken to contain the spread of the coronavirus. And there were a lot of signs that were critical of Whitmer. The Whitler, signs were back again. And some of the people that I talked to were quite upset with her.
Do we know about plans to continue these protests? Can you tell at all whether it's the same group or groups organizing and attending?
There's clearly a Facebook movement to try and get people to continue coming to the Capitol to protest this. And it's become kind of a thing on Facebook and Twitter that there's Michiganders against excessive quarantines. And now there's a Michiganders against excessive quarantines. And, that this has become a protest, counter-protest event. Although the counter-protest, pretty much people who stay in their vehicles, because if they didn't, then the counter demonstration would be beyond ironic.
Rick, thanks very much for the update.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Rick Pluta is Capitol Bureau Chief, filing for Michigan's public radio stations. We turn now to State Representative Sarah Anthony, a Democrat from Lansing who made some waves after the April 30th protest by turning up at the State House with her own escort of armed guards. Sarah Anthony, welcome back to Stateside.
Thank you for having me.
You know, since the last time we spoke, a couple of protests have played out at Lansing, including today's activity. The first one was quite large. The second, on April 30th, was not as big, but it was pretty loud and pretty well-armed. And as it's been reported, a number of folks there were Michigan militia, Proud Boys, or affiliated with other white supremacist groups. What was it like being in Lansing that day?
You know, I can only describe it as terrifying, to see the presence of not only, symbols of hate and racism like nooses and swastikas and Confederate flags, but also the presence of large firearms, and not just on the Capitol lawn, but inside the building where we were trying to vote and just do our job. And, you know, the presence of those hateful symbols like Confederate flags and nooses, I think that they are quite triggering to someone like me. I'm a Black woman, and those send a very clear message of intimidation for an individual like me who is really just there to do the job and do the work of my constituents.
A few days after that April 30th protest, you came to work and you had some friends with you, escorts who were Black men who were also heavily armed in the manner of the original protesters. Can you tell us what informed that decision?
So the day of the protest, I went on social media, and as you know, I represent the city of Lansing, and I went on Facebook to essentially let people in Lansing know about the lay of the land, you know, and give a bird's eye view of what was happening with the protests. Because when these protests happen, they really do impact, you know, the neighbors and the residents in and around downtown Lansing. But I think in the midst of me giving kind of an update, I think I just had an emotional response. And I think constituents in my community felt as though I didn't appear to be safe, that I felt intimidated. And so a group of folks in our community reached out and said, it didn't seem like you had protection. It didn't seem like you were covered. And so a group of individuals who happened to be African American showed up to the Capitol and escorted me. And I did feel safer knowing that they were there to ensure that I could get to work okay. Between the buildings, between my office building and the state Capitol. And I know that that's made some international news. And I think that's at the backdrop of all of the tension that our state and our country is feeling right now.
Representative Anthony, the Sergeant of Arms for the Capitol, David Dixon, I believe is an African American. Did you speak to him about everything that's been happening at the Capitol building? I wonder how he felt about what was going on.
Yeah, he and I have had conversations just, and you know, about my personal safety, right? And obviously he can't be everywhere at all times, but you know, I've had multiple conversations with the Michigan State Police and the sergeants and even the Lansing Police. And, you know, I will say that folks have tried to step up and figure out how they can rethink security and rethink ensuring that everyone in that building is safe. And those conversations are ongoing. But I will say that, you know, Chief Dixon has been one of the biggest proponents for doing things to ensure that individuals are safe in the Capitol. But unfortunately, you know, those armed gunmen were within their rights. Currently, it is allowed for folks to carry weapons in the Capitol building. And Michigan is one of the last states to allow these types of firearms to be carried into the Capitol, which, in my opinion, poses a significant threat and risk to not just the elected officials in that building, but our staffs, the sergeant at arms themselves, and the visitors.
Do you think that you'll bring escorts to the Capitol again when you come to work?
You know, I'm going to assess the situation on a day-to-day basis, right? I have been encouraged by some of the ongoing conversations with the state police and with the sergeant at arms. But at the end of the day, I have to make sure that I get home okay and that, you know, my constituents aren't calling me, not asking about why I'm voting a certain way, right? And, you know, talking through policy ideas. You know, many of them are just calling to make sure that I'm okay, offering to gift me bulletproof vest, you know? And that is not the conversations that I want to be having with my constituents, particularly during a public health crisis. I want to be making sure that I'm doing the best I can to help folks navigate the unemployment system, right? Helping small businesses reopen, not worrying about whether I'm going to get home alive.
What work are you trying to get done today?
From the constituents' side, I mean, the number one issue that we're facing right now is the unemployment system. I mean, we have had hundreds of individuals contact us to just help them navigate this system. You know, individuals who have never been on unemployment all of a sudden are trying to figure out, you know, how they're going to feed their families, how they're going to pay the rent and ensure that they're just okay. So, you know, I've been working with my staff to ensure that we're closing that gap. But we're also taking this opportunity to think through when this public health crisis is over, What will our world look like? You know, this has shown us that there are so many broken systems. You know, whether it's our healthcare system, our education system, how we're supporting working parents, how we're supporting small businesses. This is probably one of our only opportunities we're going to have to crack open these systems, to not just go back to the way we were, but ensure that we are diligent in fixing some of these systems and actually making them work for everyone. And so that's the work that we're doing on the policy side. And in the backdrop of that, we're going to be looking at a budget that is going to have so many shortfalls. It's going to be a very challenging year.
The last time we spoke, we were discussing your signature bill, Reconnect, a program that would offer adults 25 and older a tuition-free path to an associate's degree or other certification. And as we talked about, it was signed into law in early April, but it's been on hold with the pandemic. What's going on with the funding situation right now?
You know, so we're still in the middle of this public health crisis. And so all of the financial resources that were earmarked for that program have been rededicated to COVID-19 emergency services. However, I mean, there are ongoing conversations that we're having with the governor's administration, with all of the stakeholders that we brought together to make Reconnect real for people. I mean, it's one of the things that has been a bright spot for individuals. Folks have contacted our office and, you know, contacted me on social media and just said, you know, I'm a frontline worker and I don't want to stay in this job anymore, right? I work at a grocery store and, you know, I'm happy to be here. I'm happy to be employed, but I need a certification. I need a skilled trade. I need something additional after my high school, you know, diploma to help make my life a little easier, to help me actually, you know, reach the middle class. And I think that the policy is amazing, and I'm glad that it was signed into law. But we are going to be having conversations at the federal level to see how we can find funding to make this program a reality.
Sarah Anthony, thanks for your time. We're looking forward to touching base with you again this year.
Thank you.
Representative Sarah Anthony, a Democrat from Lansing. Michigan's colleges and universities have a new challenge, gearing up to handle new regulations on sexual assault complaints recently released by Secretary of Education Betsy DeVos.
It will also impact how these hearings are to be conducted and the school's responsibility for failure to do so.
After the break, we'll hear what this will mean for investigation of pending and future cases. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Quite a bit of news is slipping through the cracks these days. And there's one bit of information from higher education that might be of special interest in Michigan. On May 6th, the U.S. Department of Education issued some new rules for how sexual assault investigations are handled on college campuses. Given the history with MSU's Larry Nassar investigation and an active inquiry into the late University of Michigan sports doctor Robert Anderson underway, our state's experience may well have informed this policy. Marissa Pollack is a sports management lecturer at the University of Michigan School of Kinesiology and a practicing attorney. She recently wrote an article for the website The Conversation about what the new rules might mean. Marissa, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you, April.
Can you give us some context for what kind of guidance the Department of Education has offered universities in the past for how these matters should be handled?
Sure. Under Title IX in the past, the Department of Education and the Office for Civil Rights in particular has issued guidance to schools and universities on how to handle sexual assault investigations. That guidance doesn't have the force of law, and the guidance under the new Trump administration was rescinded by Secretary DeVos. In its place, her department came up with proposed regulations that will have the force of binding law when they become effective. And those revised new regulations were issued last week on May 6th.
So these are consequential, and it appears the gist of it is it tightens the definitions for sexual assault as it's investigated in colleges, correct?
Yeah, there's a number of key changes that will impact not only the definition of sexual harassment and assault under Title IX, but it will also impact how these hearings are to be conducted and the school's responsibility for failure to do so.
How do the evidentiary standards as laid out in these regulations, how will they compare with, I don't know, say what police and prosecutors use in criminal cases?
It's important to understand that Title IX does not apply criminal standards. Title IX pertains to sex discrimination in educational programs. So when sexual misconduct occurs on a college campus, for example, it entails a code of conduct policy violation, not a criminal matter. So like all other conduct violations, schools in the past have decided what standard of proof they use. And it's not a criminal standard, but it's what has been called a preponderance of the evidence standard, which means it's more likely than not that the allegations are true. So again, because it's not a criminal matter, it has not been subject to the highest burden of proof. The new regulations, however, will increase or give schools the option to increase the standard of proof from this lower preponderance of the evidence standard to a much higher clear and convincing evidence standard under the law. It will give schools the option to do that.
I mean, is there a compelling reason for schools to do that if they're trying to protect their own liability?
What's happened since the prior guidance under the Obama administration was that a lot of schools were reviewing and investigating alleged assault and punishing alleged perpetrators who were found responsible. Those particularly students who were disciplined under that policy, in turn, have sued universities. And there are many, many of these cases claiming that there wasn't a full and fair investigation and that they were unfairly disciplined. So schools have been subject to liability from the actual student perpetrators who were found responsible. So by raising the standard of proof, some believe the accused students will have a fairer standard and schools will be less likely to face those types of lawsuits from perpetrators who claim that they didn't get a full and fair hearing.
Marissa, one of the problems with investigating sexual assault is that there are so many instances in gray areas, meaning to say maybe there weren't witnesses to an incident. Possibly one of the parties had been drinking. Sometimes things come down to he said, she said. One of the dividends of the Me Too movement was the idea that victims should be believed. And a number of schools with long-standing issues with accused abusers like U of M and Ohio State University suddenly had to deal very publicly with these cases. What do you think the new Department of Ed rules suggest about how our institutions of higher education will deal with these issues in the future?
Many critics of the new regulations would argue that the victims will be severely impacted. That is, victim advocates are concerned that the new rules will discourage victims from coming forward because the new regulations now require that schools conduct live hearings with cross-examination in connection with sexual misconduct complaints. This wasn't required before, and it will allow, for example, an accused perpetrator through counsel or through legal advisors to actually cross-examine the complainant. Many would argue this will intimidate and cause further emotional harm to sexual assault survivors. On the other hand, others are concerned that accused perpetrators are entitled to greater due process protections and that these new rules might make it more difficult to prove a case, but it will afford them more protection in these investigations that were previously, in some instances, biased toward the victims.
What does it mean that these rules came out at a time when victims and perpetrators, and certainly colleges and universities, have so much else going on?
I think there's almost uniform criticism of the Secretary of Education issuing these at this particular time with an effective date of August 14, because these new regulations will require that schools carefully review and revise their policies to ensure compliance. That for many schools will require a significant overhaul of what they currently have in place. Given the major demands on schools right now during the COVID-19 pandemic, it's impractical to expect schools to fully revamp policies in such a short period of time. They have to coordinate and train staff and personnel. They have to develop and implement new investigative tools and hearing requirements. They have to consider virtual hearings if necessary, and so forth. So the timing could not be worse, considering the major demands on schools and universities right now to even operate. Although the stated effective date is August 14th, we're going to see legal action to block these proposed regulations.
Attorney Marissa Pollack is a lecturer in sports management at the University of Michigan School of Kinesiology. Marissa, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, April.
Michigan's built environment has been heavily influenced by Asia. As early as the 1920s, Chinese students were coming here to study architecture at the University of Michigan and the Cranbrook Academy of Art. In the late 1940s, we saw an influx of Japanese-American students. Minoru Yamasaki famously put his stamp on Rule's Bakery in Detroit and later the world, with projects like the World Trade Center Towers, Oberlin's Conservatory of Music, the Pacific Science Center, and so many other memorable places. The name Huayi may be less well known to you, but you've almost certainly experienced the designs he made famous in shopping centers across Michigan and the U.S. As we've been driving past malls empty of cars and people, this seems like a moment to consider their design, their function, and their makers. Mark Harvey is a state archivist with the Michigan History Center, and he joins us now with more on Huayi. Mark, welcome back to Stateside.
Thank you.
How did you become aware of Huayi's work?
We have a large collection from the Michigan chapter of the AIA, the American Institute of Architects. And in those research files, we were looking for some more information on Minoru Yamasaki, and alphabetically, Huayi is right there next to him, and one of our staff pulled the file out and went down that rabbit hole.
How did Huayi come to Detroit?
He has an interesting trip to Detroit. He grew up in California, then served in World War II as a gunner and navigator in the Army Air Corps, actually flying missions against Chinese positions. And then after the war, he did like many people did and went to college, and he happened to land at the University of Detroit and became an architectural engineer after getting a degree at University of Detroit.
I was interested to read that one of Huayi's earliest projects revolved around the redevelopment of Detroit's Skid Row, raising the city's first Chinatown to make room for the Lodge Freeway and Cobo Hall Arena. How did he get involved in that? Do you know?
Early on in his career, he set up his own shop and was contracted by Charles Blessing, the city planner, to help create an international village project at that Cobo Arena site. And so he worked with the Chinese Merchants Association, who really didn't want to be a part of that international village. They wanted to maintain their own identity. But he did work on that project through his contact with Charles Blessing, and it didn't work out. The plans eventually got scrapped, and then the Chinese Merchant Association actually came back and hired him to develop their commercial area north of there.
Why was Huayi so interested in shopping malls as a point of interaction?
I think it stems from that modernist perspective that was prevalent and really seems to be a continuation of other architects' visions, notably a gentleman named Victor Groen, who built the Northland Mall complex, which was one of the country's first malls. I mean, there's always problems with saying something's the first, but it was the first cluster mall that was centered around a flagship store and had air conditioning, and that was in the 90s. And Gruen was, he believed that malls were a community asset, that they were more than just retail centers. They were all encompassing and were an asset to the community, and that you would have medical offices, parks, you know, everything that you would have in a functioning town in this one development. And Yi really continued that vision. He was very interested in the idea of relational building, so that, you know, a building couldn't stand on its own. You wouldn't build a certain style of building next to a completely different style. There needed to be continuity, and that was easily achievable in shopping malls, not the least of which was because they usually were built in former agricultural fields. So you didn't really have a lot of competing buildings.
Right. You know, we've become so hyper aware of some of the consequences of shopping malls as a thing in American life. The devastation that they wreaked on main streets in small town America, and, you know, the consumer culture that was part and parcel of them. But it kind of sounds like what Wai Yi and Victor Gruen and some of these earlier architects were driving at was what we would now call mixed-use, densely packed urban development.
It's exactly what it is. And it, what's interesting is it's come around full circle, because those early malls were a reaction to, I mean, all the way back to the 1920s, they were a reaction to the increased use of automobiles that were clogging downtown commercial centers. Then you start seeing the sprawl happen as a reaction to that densely packed commercial area. And then from that, you see people like Rune saying, hey, you know what? We can just create a whole new community and integrate these retail centers as part of the communities. And you see that with, you know, things like Levittown in Southdale and in California. They were really centered around a holistic community, just not a commercial center.
After Levittown and some of the other developments around the country, people started to see more of the benefits of this.
So the developers that worked with the architects, they saw the initial retail success and abandoned the community aspect of it pretty quickly. And you'll see architects like Gruen basically turn on their own vision because it wasn't being fulfilled by the builders and they would abandon it. But Yi continued that vision. And I think partly because he was as interested in the architectural form as he was the community aspect. I think it's why you see these interesting components of malls like fountains and common areas and food courts. They're sort of an homage to that community aspect, although they weren't really pulled off that great.
Do you know how he felt about seeing some of his malls age out or just see the form overall, you know, grow somewhat stagnant?
We don't have any direct quotes from him, but just seeing how he progressed in his career, he became a little disillusioned with the fact that the malls that he would create would sometimes be added onto, which wasn't part of his vision. Again, he was very holistic in his vision of building these structures as, you know, a continuous architectural structure. And so a lot of times with malls, you'll see, especially here in Lansing, he built the Lansing Mall, and you'll see lots of tack-ons on the end of those malls. Interestingly, though, after he retired and sold to a new management company, Yi & Associates, which is still in business, continued that concept. They built the Novi Town Center, which, if you've ever been there, sort of has a lot of those elements that we've talked about. Although it seems no matter how hard we try to do that mixed use, that intentional community sort of bleeds through.
Tell us more about some of his designs that are still with us.
Yes, he did Lansing Mall. He did Fair Lane. He has a mall in Georgetown in D.C., among others.
Mark, as I mentioned a little bit earlier, we're in this period now where the COVID-19 pandemic has left the malls that are still out there just completely standing all by themselves and devoid of people. And there have been some serious questions raised about whether America still wants malls. Do you think there'll be anything lost if these structures that Wai Yi and Victor Gruen and others spent so much time on just fade into history?
Yeah, I think it's, when I looked back at some of the statistics of malls and their use, I mean, obviously the 80s were the heydays of malls. And at one point in the late 80s, there's a statistic that said an American family averaged 4 visits per month to a mall. I grew up in the 80s. I can't imagine. I don't think I went there that much, but maybe what? Maybe
oh, man. I grew up in the 80s, and I can almost guarantee that was the case in our family.
I did, because we did. We hung out at the mall, and my kids look at me like I'm crazy. Like, why would you hang out at the mall? And I guess maybe there was that community aspect. I'm not sure. But it's interesting because we went from, if we look in Michigan, in our urban areas, sort of that urban decay of the 70s, and the shift to the malls. And now that's really reversed, right? We've shifted back to the urban areas and away from these malls. And now they are the relics standing there on the fringe of the urban areas. It's sort of like the urban areas are returning the favor.
Yeah. Mark, do your kids know about Cinnabon?
Well, they know about Auntie Anne's pretzels.
They might change their tune if they were aware of the deep and rich culinary history of 80s malls.
They know about Orange Julius because of me, unfortunately.
That's important. Mark, thank you so much for telling us more about Yi. And who knows, maybe we can meet up over a froyo and talk some more about this in the future.
Oh, yeah. There's going to be plenty of room.
Mark Harvey is a state archivist with the Michigan History Center. After the break, we'll hear about the dozens of Michigan children who've come down with a serious condition that is believed to be related to COVID-19.
And some of these kids are very sick, sick enough to require a ventilator or even a heart-lung bypass machine.
We'll bring you up to speed on what doctors know at this point. That's next on Stateside. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Governor Gretchen Whitmer this week announced layoff days for many state employees, but work continues in offices of the state amid one of the most consequential years in modern Michigan history. You might have heard this is an election year. Secretary of State offices are closed, along with much of the rest of the state. We called up Jocelyn Benson, Michigan Secretary of State, to talk more about the work her office is doing right now and what lies ahead later in the year. Secretary Benson, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Are you working from home?
Yes, I am.
What does that look like in your role?
It means near constant Zoom calls and communications. And I will say there were a few days, including our May 5th election, where I emerged from my home to visit and really stand in solidarity with our clerks who were working elections that day. And so it was educational in many ways to go over to the west side of the state and spend the day visiting folks in Allegan and Muskegon and Grand Rapids and Kent County. But for the most part, I am, I have a office in my basement where I spend my days doing Zoom calls from 8 in the morning till sometimes even 8 in the evening.
You have children, don't you?
I have a 3-year-old who thinks he's 10. I'm sure he thinks if you asked him how old he was, he would say he was maybe a teenager. He's been very, it's been interesting to support him as well during this time. But he's been very understanding and he does Zoom calls with his preschool class. So sometimes I let him sit in my area where I do Zoom videos. I've been focusing on how fortunate I feel to be able to spend this extra time with him and, you know, eating lunch with him and things like that. And he's been remarkably supportive and just understanding of when I need to do a call or just sitting, you know, quietly and watching while I do a video. So for the most part, I've been very fortunate.
That sounds like the most amazing 3-year-old in the history of 3-year-olds.
he's remarkably mature. The other day he did say, "Mama, why are you wearing makeup? Do you have to do a video call?" So he's very observant and he's very thoughtful. But we also have a large backyard where he goes out oftentimes and plays in the sandbox or in the swing set, so he gets lots of activity out there too, and he's able to play independently, which is really nice.
Your department has been moving slowly online in general, trying to get some of the things that we used to do in person onto a digital platform, but there are still mm-hmm. some things that have to be done in person. The photos taken for driver's licenses, having documents seen and approved. How do you imagine the Secretary of State's business might begin these services again before we have a vaccine, which, you know, maybe as much as a year or 2 years mm-hmm. down the line?
I think it's two things. One, noting that those two transactions, for example, that you mentioned, photos for licenses and document review, in many ways, those can and have in other industries gone virtual.
Such as in real estate.
Go in personally.
Such as in real estate or legal matters. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. So first we, and this requires potentially in some cases legislative changes, but we want to continue to explore ways to enable more virtual transactions and educate the public on how to engage in those virtual transactions. That's been a priority of my administration from day one. We're going to continue to expand that. And we've certainly seen more people taking advantage of our virtual offerings during this time. But secondly, certainly in the short term and probably for the medium term, as well as part of the long term, that in-person transaction is going to have to be preserved. And our branch offices will, we hope, resume operations quite shortly. And when they do, they will be by appointment only for the immediate future to avoid crowding in offices and also ensure that in the limited and increasingly limited times in which people do need those in-person transactions, they're able to get them. But while we continue to encourage people to go online or do their transactions by mail.
One of the major tasks that you oversee is a new redistricting committee that's scheduled to begin work next year. Has groundwork begun for getting the parameters set for that at this point?
Yes, we are just about to end the first of three phases for implementing the Citizens Redistricting Commission. And anyone can go to redistrictingmichigan.org to track our progress and get many of their questions answered. But on June 1st, in just a few weeks, the application window will close for citizens wanting to serve on the commission. So people can still go online and apply. And one of the challenges that we met and overcame early on in the pandemic was the fact that to apply to serve on the commission, you have to have your application notarized. So we were able to take advantage of the governor's executive order, allowing for remote notary, and quickly build a system for people to notarize their form from their home. And in doing so, we've been able to continue to hit our targets of getting a significant number of people from all across the state to apply. As of now, citizens in 82 of our 83 counties have applied. We're still trying to get someone from Ontonagon. We're working on it. We've focused on it. But to have that still wide level of acceptance and engagement, even during a time like this, people are continuing to apply, continuing to express an interest in serving on the commission. It's been very encouraging. And that's one of the things that we really haven't lost any ground on in terms of our momentum for building that. Now, after June 1st, applications will close and we'll begin the random selection process, and the commission will be seated and phase three will begin in the fall.
Are you confident that this process can and should go forward in the post-COVID environment that we now find ourselves?
Yes, I am. In part, if it continues to meet the principles that we established early on in this process of ensuring it is independent, citizen-led, and transparent, all three of those things can happen even in this new normal, whether it's requiring the commission to meet remotely or meet with complying with social distancing and, other health guidelines. The commission is required, once it's seated this fall, to have 15 town halls across the state. And so working to make sure those are done in a way that's accessible.
I mean, I'm sure I don't have to tell you that public meetings via Zoom have something of a mixed record at present.
Yep. They do. And notably, those town halls will likely happen in 2021. So, my hope is that they'll be able to have some sort of in-person element, if not be fully in person by then. The fact that all this and all of these dates are enshrined in our Constitution has created a sense of forward progress that we've continued to meet our deadlines and, continue to not cut corners in order to meet the expectations of the voters who created this commission.
Are you and your staff going forward with the understanding that elections will be held in person this fall?
We know two things about this fall's elections with certainty. One, that they will be held on time and on schedule. And two, that every citizen will have a right to vote by mail. And so we're working on enforcing both of those pieces right now and ensuring that citizens know how to exercise their right to vote by mail effectively and securely, and that our clerks have all the tools they need to receive and process and count what will, under any circumstance, be more ballots sent by mail than ever before in our state's history. That said, we will always seek to preserve some way of in-person voting as well, both for voters with limited physical abilities, but also for voters who simply decide on election day that they want to vote and cast their ballot. So just as we did in our May 5th election, we will have some way to allow safe in-person voting. And we're looking at various models of how to do that, including acquiring PPE, masks, gloves, and all the rest for our election workers if needed in this fall's election.
Has there been any substantial change since March of the number of Michiganders already thinking ahead to November and trying to get in line for absentee ballots?
Yes, we anticipate, and this starts in just a few days, that more citizens than ever will be requesting their ballots be sent to them in the mail. And notably, once a ballot is sent to you in the mail, you can return it through the mail, but there are also you can also return it in person, drop it off at your clerk's office, for example, if you want that additional sense of confirmation that it's been received. We're also working at looking at installing drop boxes around the state and other ways to encourage ballot return and options for ballot return. And if there are precincts on election day, you can even bring it to the precinct and vote right there. So there's as long as the ballot's received by 8 o'clock on election day, people have various options for returning it. And so we are encouraging citizens to sign up to receive their ballots for August and November. And you can sign up for August and November with the same form.
Well, Secretary Benson, thank you for your time today, and we'll look forward to checking back in with you later in the year.
Certainly. Thank you, and stay safe and stay healthy.
Jocelyn Benson, Secretary of State for Michigan. As devastating as COVID-19 has been, one thing that has brought some comfort is that children seem to rarely get sick. But children's hospitals in Michigan and elsewhere are starting to see kids with symptoms that can be very serious, and they think it could be linked to the virus. Michigan Radio is part of a COVID-19 collaboration with Bridge Magazine and the Detroit Free Press. Joining us today from the Free Press is Kristen Jordan-Shamus. Kristen, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Doctors are calling this condition pediatric multi-inflammatory syndrome. Do we know how many kids in Michigan might have this and how sick they are?
Sure. So here in Michigan, doctors say they've seen about 24 cases. Most have been treated at Children's Hospital of Michigan in Detroit. And there was one case that could be related to this syndrome, and it was seen at C.S. Mott Children's Hospital in Ann Arbor. But in New York, about 100 cases have been reported, including 3 deaths. It's also been seen in kids in Illinois, California, the United Kingdom, and Spain. And some of these kids are very sick. Sick enough to require a ventilator or even a heart-lung bypass machine called ECMO.
I understand you've talked to a couple of doctors about this.
I have. I spoke with Dr. Rudolph Valentini at Children's Hospital of Michigan, and I also talked with Dr. Elizabeth Lloyd from C.S. Mott Children's Hospital.
Let's listen to a little bit of what we heard from Dr. Valentini about the kids he's seeing.
Some are intubated. Some are requiring very aggressive IV medications and ICU level of monitoring.
Kristen, how much do doctors know about what's causing this condition?
They're really not sure. It's new. They believe it could be tied to coronavirus. Some of the patients are testing positive for active COVID-19 infections. And some of the kids have antibodies that show that they've previously been infected to the virus. But some children have tested negative for both. I talked to Dr. Lloyd, and she said that there is a suspicion that this is linked to COVID-19.
We suspect that if this is related to COVID, it's more of a post-infectious inflammatory syndrome that occurs after the actual viral infection is either resolving or actually has resolved. That could explain why some patients test negative.
So what should we be looking for? What are the symptoms?
Parents should watch for fever and a rash that lasts a few days in kids. Some children will have a combination of symptoms that could include cracked lips, red irritated eyes, or a bright red tongue. There might be swollen lymph nodes or stomach pain, diarrhea or vomiting. And some kids will also have an unusual swelling or peeling of the skin on the hands or feet. And Dr. Valentini says some kids might have a combination of these factors, not all of them, but maybe a few, and that all of them are reason for parents to consider calling their doctor.
This sounds really scary. Kristen, how worried should parents be about this right now?
Well, there have only been a few kids who've been affected by this so far. And while it is serious, Dr. Lloyd at Mott urges parents not to panic because this inflammatory syndrome appears to be rare. But still, Dr. Valentini says it is changing the perception that COVID-19 doesn't severely affect children.
It makes me nervous, to be very honest. I mean, my kids are grown now, but if I had little ones in school, knowing what I now know, I would want to minimize the exposure risk. And, it seems as though initially we only worried about the children getting infected so that they could potentially share it to their parents who could be at higher risk, or their grandparents who could be at much higher risk. But now we're seeing that the kids themselves can be very ill from this.
So this seems like it could have some serious consequences in decisions over things like reopening schools and daycares and summer camps. Have you heard anything about that?
Dr. Valentini seemed pretty concerned about it. And he had said that he could see, because there's now knowledge about this inflammatory syndrome, that he could see online schooling for a while, at least until a vaccine is developed, to try to protect these kids.
Kristen, I happen to know that you are a mom. As you were reporting this story, I mean, was it making you feel more anxious about your own kid?
It did make me nervous, largely because one of my daughters did have some of these symptoms. She has allergies, and her eyes were really, really red a couple of weeks ago. She had a rash, and I thought for sure it just had to be allergies. And so we treated her with her allergy medicine. And then when I talked to Dr. Valentini, I thought maybe I made the wrong decision and maybe I should have called her pediatrician instead. But one thing that he told me was that most of these children do have fever. And even though it is allergy season, and even though children will have rashes and red eyes and that sort of thing in response to the allergens that are out in the air, really, it's fever that should be the additional factor that would make you think that this is something more than just allergies.
Were you able to learn anything about what they're doing for these kids or what the likelihood of recovery might be at this point? I mean, if they're getting treated on ventilators, that sounds pretty serious.
It is very serious. And so far, no children in Michigan have died, Dr. Valentini said. But one of the things that he said is that the sooner kids get in for treatment, the better the outcome will be. So it's really important to take these early symptoms seriously and to get them care right away. He said some children have come into the hospital with relatively normal looking hearts, and then they progress pretty quickly to needing a lot of extra help and having this affect their hearts as well. Super important to get care quickly. Once the children are in the hospital, he said that they're being treated with a combination of treatments. They're using a cocktail that they would ordinarily use for children with Kawasaki's disease, which this syndrome seems to mirror pretty closely. But they're also adding some drugs that are used to treat rheumatological diseases like arthritis, like rheumatoid arthritis, for example, or lupus. And this combination of medication seems to be helping a lot of these children. And luckily, here in Michigan, several children have left the hospital and have been discharged home.
Did you hear anything from either of the docs about them being worried about just not knowing who has it the same way they worry about that with COVID?
Yeah, I asked about whether, because it's really hard in Michigan for children to get tested. And I guess it's that way around the country, too. I don't imagine that Michigan is really all that special when it comes to that. But the preference for, I should say, the priority for treatment is older people, because older people typically have more severe symptoms to COVID than younger people do. But testing, they said, really won't make that much of a difference, because a lot of these children are testing negative for
active infection. A lot of these children have antibodies, which show that they might have been exposed weeks ago and are just developing this inflammatory syndrome now.
Chris and Jordan Seamus from the Detroit Free Press reported this story as part of a COVID collaboration between the Free Bridge magazine and Michigan Radio. Kristen, thank you so much for stopping back in again and for the story.
Thank you, and take care.
That's Stateside for today. I'm April Baer. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you tomorrow.